morning, everybody. Please be seated. Our first case this morning is a 60-minute argument, Richardson versus State, 54951. Ms. Thomas, Mr. Sheik, and Ms. Weckerly are the counsel. Ms. Weckerly for the respondent, Ms. Thomas and Mr. Sheik for the appellant. Mr. Sheik.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Justices. My name is David Sheik. I'm the Special Public Defender for Clark County. I'm here with Jonelle Thomas, who's our appellate deputy. We will both be arguing the case this morning. We've tried to split the time, where I'm going to try to use about 10 minutes, and then and she'll use 10, and we'd like to reserve the remaining 10 for rebuttal. I tried this case back in 2009, along with Attorney Alzora Jackson. The reason that I'm here today to argue is to talk about one issue, and that issue has to do with the closing argument that I made at the conclusion of the trial portion of the case and the objection that was sustained that prevented me from arguing our theory of the defense in the case. When you prepare a case for trial, you have to be thinking about your closing argument at the very beginning. You don't come up with your closing argument after all the evidence is in, because during the course of that trial, you have to ask questions of witnesses that are going to lead to the inferences you want to draw at the time of your closing argument. And that's what we did in this case. As we all know, the order of evidence is not always smooth during the presentation of the state's case or the defendant's case. There are witnesses out of order, where you make one point with a witness at one point in time, and then maybe 2 days later, that point gets tied up to another point you make with a different witness. All of it keyed to and planned to, in defense of a criminal case, create reasonable doubt, to allow argument as to inferences that exist in the evidence that's presented to the court, to the jury, that your client is not guilty of the charges. The closing argument is the chance to tie it all together. It's a chance to put all the little pieces that you've created during the course of this trial into the bigger picture being that the state has failed in their burden of proof, and there's a reasonable doubt that exists in this case. You're always looking for that time in closing argument when you stand there and you're making your point and you're drawing these inferences from the evidence, when you look to see a juror that is looking back at you and their eyes open and they have that moment of clarity. I now understand why you asked that witness on day one this, and this witness on day two this, and why you spent so much time with that crime scene analyst on the forensics and the blood spatter, why that was so important. Because you knew you would be standing here at the end of the trial summarizing this for me, so I can determine whether or not, being the juror, you have shown reasonable doubt in the case. There's numbers of cases that have talked about the importance of closing argument. But a summation or closing argument is crucial to a fair trial. It's crucial to the right to a defense and the right to due process. The state must prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. And this means that the state must prove the defendant's theory, defendant's inferences from the evidence that was presented, is not, in fact, a possibility and something that creates reasonable doubt. The U.S. Supreme Court in Herring versus New York talked about the importance of closing argument in a criminal case. Now, in Herring, they were dealing with a statute that said when you have a bench trial, the defense attorney is not allowed at all to make a closing argument. But the discussion of the court of the importance of closing argument is directly on point to what we're dealing with here. The U.S. Supreme Court said in Herring that closing argument for the defense is a basic element of the adversarial fact-finding process in a criminal trial. Interference with the right to closing arguments is a denial of the constitutional right to present a defense to criminal charges. Same principles apply here. When the defense is cut off from presenting in their closing argument the inferences that would prove that their client is not guilty beyond a reasonable doubt and therefore should be acquitted of the charges. This isn't a case where we are attempting to mislead the jury or we're pulling things from whole cloth. As I always do when I give a closing argument to a jury, I stood before that jury and said,
What I say is not evidence in this case. You are the triers of fact. You decide what the evidence is in this case. The prosecution, what they say is not evidence in this case. We're going to have different positions as to what the evidence shows in this case. But you, as trier of facts, make that decision. The crux of my argument during closing was, in fact, that Robbie Denhart committed these murders, that Thomas Richardson was not present when Robbie Denhart committed those murders. Key to that was the fact that portions of Robbie Denhart's testimony and previous statements were not accurate, that did not match the forensic and physical evidence discovered at the scene, that Robbie Denhart was not to be believed. We talked about the fact that Robbie Denhart was clearly an accomplice in this case, by his own testimony, at the very least, is an accomplice in this case, and the key need for corroboration of that accomplice was at the heart of the things we were arguing and trying to prove to this jury. And Ms. Thomas is going to address the accomplice issues and whether or not there was sufficient corroboration. But from my point of view during closing argument, that's what I was going to. This man is not corroborated. His story is not true. It does not make sense. It's repelled by the physical evidence in the case, and you can't believe him. But you can look at the evidence, and you can draw inferences from what that evidence does show in this case. How was he contradicted by the evidence? I spent a lot of time during my closing, and there's a lot of information in the briefs that we filed in this case talking about what the evidence was and was not in this case. I went through that completely through my closing argument. There was a PowerPoint I make reference to during the closing argument where I go down point by point what was proven at the scene, what was proven against Robbie, and what wasn't proven against Tom, all for the purpose of the conclusion, the final summary to our position in the case is that Tom Richardson was not present at the time Robbie Denhart committed the murders of Mr. Volker and Ms. Feldman, and that the evidence led to that conclusion by our interpretation of that evidence. Just as I was starting that argument, it's set forth in the opening brief, before I even have a chance to get into what it is, the state objected and indicated that it was speculation. The court overruled that objection because I said, I'm just arguing the facts, Your Honor. Started again and drew another immediate objection, saying that stating facts not in evidence. That's an objection that you make to when you're leading a witness and you're assuming facts in your question. It's not an objection to closing argument where you're summarizing the evidence and properly making the inferences that you should make as to the guilt or innocence of your client and what that evidence shows. At that point, we approached the bench, and the sidebar is presented in the reply brief of what we discussed and the efforts that I made to go into why I should be allowed to make those arguments. The prosecutor objected at the bench and told the court, he's using a scenario, and absolutely I was presenting a scenario, an inference based on the evidence that was presented, that not a single witness testified to. We don't have to have a witness that testified that he saw Tom Richardson leaving the trailer before the murders happened. The fact that there's no physical evidence in the trailer that links my client to being present at the time of the homicide is enough for me to draw the inference he left. I don't need evidence of that to make that argument in my closing statement to this jury. The court, however, disagreed with that concept. I went along and said, look, Robbie Denhart testified. And he testified that when he made the call to Mr. Volker, the man that he killed, and talked about coming to Las Vegas, Volker invited him to Las Vegas. And the plan was Robbie was going to get a ride to Las Vegas, and then he was going to get a ride back from Mr. Volker. He was going to be left in Las Vegas. They were going to go back to Lake Arrowhead where they're going to do the repairs on another house. That came from Robbie's own mouth. That very scenario that they say there's no evidence was, there actually was evidence of it. The court did not accept that.
So, Mr. Sheik, if it's error, is it Why is it not harmless error?
Because, Your Honor, I was not allowed to summarize my case and present a coherent argument and inference that my client was not present at the time of the homicide.
And how do we go from a standard of review of abuse of discretion to maybe a violation of due process? Is that a possibility? How do you view it?
Due process is a large concept and includes fairness, and it includes the right to have a full and complete defense presented on your behalf. And a full and complete defense includes the right to be able to stand before that jury and make a closing argument. And that was denied here. We were denied the ability to bring all that together for the jury. And all I needed to do was convince one juror, you know what, that makes sense, and there's nothing to say it didn't happen that way. How do we know it didn't happen that way? We don't know it from the forensic evidence. We don't know it from my witness testimony. So maybe it did happen that way. And if I think it could have happened that way, I have a reasonable doubt. Therefore, I can't return a verdict of guilty. That's how it's denial of due process.
Mr. Sheik, could you clarify? Go ahead and finish your answer to the chief.
I'm fine.
And one last thing. The prosecution, you'll notice, in their rebuttal argument, got up and argued against the scenario I was not allowed to present. So the court let them argue against what they wouldn't let me say. And so, as a fundamental fairness concept, clearly, Mr. Richardson was prejudiced by it. I'm sorry, Justice.
Oh, it's fine. I wondered if you could clarify. Maybe I have a misunderstanding. There seems to me to be a difference between arguing that Mr. Richardson returned to Riverside and therefore wasn't present when the killings occurred, as opposed to arguing, which I understood you were permitted to do, that he was not in the home and there was no evidence that placed him in Las Vegas after the trip to the Taco Bell. Were you, in fact, permitted to argue those two points?
We were permitted to argue, after we approached the bench, that Mr. Richardson brought Mr. Denhart to Las Vegas, and that Mr. Richardson was in Las Vegas and at the Taco Bell, because obviously there was a video. And we were allowed to argue that the evidence didn't show he was present in the trailer. But beyond that, we weren't allowed to argue inferences as to where, if he wasn't in the trailer, where was he?
This is a follow-up to the chief's question. Since you were permitted to argue that Richardson was not in the residence, the forensic evidence didn't support his presence in the residence, then whether he was in Riverside or some other place in Las Vegas or some other place in the world, he wasn't in the trailer when the killings occurred, and that argument you were able to make.
That argument we weren't able to make.
So the fact that he wasn't in Riverside, how is that, if it's error, prejudicial?
Because it leaves a huge hole in the line of reasoning that you're trying to make to this jury. If I stood there and attempted to argue the scenario of that he had dropped him off and he had returned to Southern California, I was not allowed to make that argument. I was not allowed to suggest any other possibilities of where he could have been. And clearly, if you're a juror, and it's like the defendant is not there, where was the defendant?
So you're saying that the judge's ruling prevented you from accounting for his whereabouts?
Absolutely. And there are phone conversations where he says in a phone conversation to Kim Ross, and that's Robbie's mother, when Robbie came back from Las Vegas, he told me what he did, okay, which would imply that Mr. Richardson was in Southern California. Robbie returned and told him, that's how he knew those facts. That was a call that we had, and you'll see there's a blurb in here where I start to say, Your Honor, there's calls, and I'm cut off and I don't get to finish, but I was talking about those calls that talk about other scenarios. And I've gone way over my 10 minutes, but this, to me, there is nothing more important for a criminal defense attorney than after effectively going through and establishing his case, being denied the right to stand before that jury and explain why that evidence dictates that his client be acquitted, that they find there was a reasonable doubt. And we were denied that in this case. And I would urge you to find that it's not only error, but it's prejudicial error, and it requires reversal. And I'll turn the rest of the time over to Ms. Thomas and ask those questions. Thank you very much, Justices.
Good morning, Justices. There are a number of issues I'd like to address. I'm prepared to address issues from the brief if the court has any questions on any of those. But what I'd first like to address is the big picture here. And that is, in this case, the defense was shut down at every stage of the proceedings from doing their job. There was a hat that wasn't impounded and available for the defense to inspect and to have tested and to have their own expert evaluate. The defense was shut down from calling the two witnesses they wanted to call in their case in chief. We objected to evidence coming in from the state, had case authority supporting that, and that evidence still came in. We were unable to obtain jury instructions in our favor, and as Mr. Sheik has just gone through, we're prevented from making a legitimate closing argument. And while each of these issues stands on their own, I think combined they demonstrate a breakdown of the adversarial system. It's not supposed to work this way. We're supposed to be on equal footing. We're supposed to be able to present a case, to present a defense, to test evidence. And at some point, you just start asking, why are we here? If we're not going to be allowed to do anything to defend our client beyond making, you know, sure, we were able to do some cross-examination, but when it came to the important issues in this case, we were shut down. I would like to start with the hat. It was set out the details in full in the briefing. As this court's aware, that a hat, which was crucial to the state's case, was found at the crime scene. Detectives picked up that hat, touched that hat, talked about that hat. They didn't photograph that hat. They didn't document where it was originally discovered. They didn't impound it formally as evidence, yet this became a centerpiece of the state's case. In evaluating this issue, I think it's very important to consider the context of the case at the time the detectives are evaluating this evidence. The bodies were found on September 10th. There was some initial crime scene work done on that day. There is no photograph showing this hat from that day, no report, no testimony that anyone saw it that day. A few days later, Detective Vaccaro goes to a Taco Bell based upon a receipt that was found and reviews a videotape where he sees the victim talking to a man in a hat. There are sunglasses over the logo, so it's not very clear, but it is clear the man is wearing a hat. He immediately thereafter goes to the crime scene, meets with crime scene people, meets with detectives, and at that point more evidence is impounded, more photographs are taken. At some point they decide to lift up the bed. The assertion is made at trial that the hat was under the bed. There is no photograph showing a hat underneath the bed at the point the bed is lifted up. Instead, what we have is a photo taken at a distance that was looking at some blood evidence on the walls, and off in the distance you see the hat hanging on the leg of the bed frame that's been put up on its side. No one testifies to putting that hat there. Yet this hat, which we can't examine, we can't see if there's DNA, fingerprints, touch DNA, we can't see if the size fits, we can't see if indeed it's the same hat that is asserted to be Mr. Richardson's hat, that's allowed to come in as evidence. The state here argues that this is a failure to gather case. We believe this is a failure to preserve case. In some ways, I don't think it matters. Under either standard, I submit that this does constitute gross negligence not to impound this evidence. And moreover, the state benefited from the loss of this evidence. It was allowed to put on this evidence despite its own failure to collect it.
To what extent?
The hat was a centerpiece of the state's case in its argument that Mr. Richardson was present in the bedroom. There's little that we can do to refute that without access to experts, without access to being able to inspect that evidence to see if it is what the state claims it to be. For the state to assert that it's found under a bed, yet not have a single documentation of that, not a single photograph of that. This is a relatively small crime scene, one bedroom. It's a double homicide. And frankly, I think we should expect more of crime scene people and detectives in this kind of situation, especially where a detective has just seen a video showing one of the deceased talking to a man in a hat. This isn't like a pair of pants that is difficult to come off during an altercation. Hats are something that can easily fly off the head. So to not impound this type of evidence, they impounded a cologne bottle, they impounded a shampoo set. To not impound an evidence of this nature is sloppy police work. This is not what we should be expecting at all. And we certainly shouldn't be allowing the state to come in and benefit by being able to present all this evidence about a hat without being able to produce it.
Counsel, the question for us is, at the time the evidence was collected, did the police have any inclination that that property might not be that of the victims? Why should they have taken it at the time? Not hindsight, but at the time.
Certainly. Detective Ficarro had just watched a video. He went from the Taco Bell to the crime scene. He had just watched a video showing the deceased talking to a man in a hat. There's a hat in the bedroom. They've collected a good number of other items. They've talked about the hat. They all acknowledge joking about it. I can conceive of no reason why they would not collect that hat in that situation. And certainly, if they don't want to preserve the evidence, that they shouldn't be allowed to benefit from their loss. They shouldn't. They were the ones solely in control of that evidence. And I realize this court uses different standards for civil cases and criminal cases on preserving evidence. I urge you not to. I think we should have the same standard. But if a civil litigant were to come in front of you in this situation, I think it would be a far different result. And here, I think it should be a far different result. I think this is just like Sandburn, just like Sparks. The state cannot be allowed to benefit from its own loss of evidence. I'd really like to save the rest of the time for rebuttal unless the court has any questions.
You have about 8 minutes and 50 seconds left. Ms. Rockley, on behalf of the state of Nevada.
Good morning. My name is Pam Weckerly. I work for the Clark County District Attorney's Office, and like Mr. Sheik, I was one of the trial lawyers on behalf of the state of Nevada, along with Chris Owens, Assistant District Attorney. Because Mr. Sheik started with the argument about him being restricted in his closing argument, I'd like to start in that area, if it's okay with the court. I'll ask the court to bear with me a little bit because I think the nature of the argument that they're making, that they were precluded from offering their theory of defense in the closing argument, requires quite a number of references to the record. His entire closing argument was in volume 15, so I'll be referencing the page numbers as I discuss what he was allowed to argue to the court. I think the distinction that Judge Leavitt made was a proper one.
Before you go down that road, do you agree that the error, if shown, is constitutional and therefore you have the burden of demonstrating that it was harmless?
I think that the court reviews the evidentiary rulings of the district court on an abuse of discretion. I don't think it rises to a constitutional level in this instance because of the arguments that they were able to make in order to put forth their theory of defense. And this was just one restriction on the argument, which I think doesn't rise to a constitutional level.
Okay. So as you go through that, though, pay attention to that because that's of concern to me what the standard of review is in this. I mean, he has a position that deprived his client of effective assistance of counsel and due process because he was not able to put forward his theory of the case, and that would trigger the constitutional standard that would put the burden clearly on you.
And I agree with you on that, but their theory of the case was clearly set forth throughout the trial and in the closing argument as well. And I'll reference those portions of the record if I may, and if there's additional questions, I'll follow. I think what the distinction that needs to be made is you're allowed to certainly argue inferences from the evidence. What you're not allowed to do is talk about facts that were never presented at the trial. And when Mr. Sheik did his closing argument, he was allowed, and properly so, to argue at length about why the jury shouldn't believe the testimony of Robert Dennhart. He told the jury that Mr. Dennhart deviated from his proffer. This is at page 3603. He identified Dennhart as the true double murderer in this case. That's at the same page. And he also said that Mr. Dennhart conveniently came up with a version of events in order to extract a deal from the state, and that's at page 3606. He also was able to argue different interpretations from the physical evidence in this case and how the physical evidence didn't match the version of events offered by Mr. Dennhart. He indicated that Dennhart's story defied common sense. That's at page 3608. He said that Mr. Dennhart's version of events wasn't consistent with the blood spatter expert testimony that was offered by the state. That's at page 3609. He mentioned that Dennhart's testimony was inconsistent with the fingerprint evidence in this case. That was at page 3604. And he also suggested that if Mr. Dennhart was to be believed, there should have been blood found in the Ford Taurus, which transported Dennhart and Richardson back to California, and there wasn't. So he made essentially a negative inference argument. You can't believe Dennhart because no blood was found in the car. And that was on page 3605. Towards the end of his argument, and he actually even said this in the record at pages 3625 and 26, he indicated that he was almost done with his closing argument. And then he said to the jury, consider this scenario that Richardson drives Dennhart to Las Vegas because Folker invited him up, and in fact, Richardson does just that. I objected at that point because a scenario to me triggers the argument that, or the suggestion that the argument that is about to be made was speculative. Court didn't rule my way on that. She overruled the objection. So that argument went forward. And Mr. Sheik continued that Mr. Richardson is at Taco Bell with Dennhart and drops them off at the trailer after eating Taco Bell and returns to Southern California. There was no evidence of that. Not a single witness testified that Richardson dropped anybody off at the trailer or returned home to Southern California, but there was no objection made either. We probably should have. Mr. Sheik continued, and then he said later, Mr. Dennhart comes back to California and tells Mr. Richardson. At that point, I objected because I thought he was going to reference a conversation that never took place. And this is at 15 ROA 3632. And that is when Judge Leavitt sustained the objection. And it was a proper objection at that point because it was referring to a conversation to which no witness had ever testified. And when you're talking about that type of conversation, you're not just making an argument about inferences from the evidence, but you're talking about something that was never presented at all or subject to challenge on cross-examination. After we did the bench conference, Judge Leavitt indicated that he would be allowed to make the argument that there's no physical evidence tying Mr. Richardson to the scene, or there's no evidence indicating that Mr. Richardson was present at the time of the murders. And in fact, at page 3632 in the same record, Mr. Sheik did continue and put forth that argument. He said that nothing puts him, meaning Richardson, in the trailer at the time of the homicides. There's nothing to argue that he was present after the three were seen at Taco Bell. So his argument that Richardson may have been present early on, but certainly wasn't present at the time of the homicide, was made to the jury. It was simply rejected. Mr. Sheik had some quarrel with the fact of what I argued in rebuttal about that possible scenario, that Mr. Richardson dropped Dennhart off and then returned back to Southern California. It was proper rebuttal, in my opinion, because the cat was already out of the bag. I considered all of that evidence speculative.
But he wasn't allowed to argue that he went back to California.
He did say, respectfully, Justice Pickering, he did say, suppose that he drops them off at the trailer after eating Taco Bell and returns to Southern California. And there was no objection to that. The objection came after he talked about the conversation.
Okay.
So I think he was able to get that piece of evidence or that argument or that suggestion out, and that was what I addressed in rebuttal, the likelihood of that facts. Or the likelihood of that scenario.
The argument was clear to the jury that what Richardson was suggesting was that he might have been present in Las Vegas prior to the murders, but he certainly wasn't a participant in the murders, and that the state couldn't tie him to being inside the trailer at that time. Because of this, I think that a close reading of the closing argument in this case and the evidentiary rulings of Judge Leavitt were proper, and that there was no error, and certainly no error of constitutional dimension.
Assuming, just for sake of argument, that we were to find that it was error to restrict that closing argument and that it was constitutional error, what would you argue that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
Well, in this case, it was certainly harmless because the jury, it's obvious, believed what Dennhart said. They rejected the whole idea that Richardson wasn't present at the time of the murder. And Dennhart's actual testimony was bolstered by other evidence in the case that placed Richardson or involved Richardson or indicated that Richardson was involved in the homicide as well. So I would say it was harmless given the balance of the evidence in this case.
Ms. Weckerly, would you talk about the red hat, the loss of evidence, and the question at least posed to us that we should adopt a similar spoliation of evidence standard for criminal as we do in civil?
Yes. The hat, as I'm sure is not a surprise, was a highly litigated aspect of this case. And as Justice Douglas indicated, I think what's important to realize is the factual scenario in which the homicide detectives are operating when they first roll out to the homicide scene. The homicide is discovered on the 10th of September of 2005. At that point, their information is that Stephen Folker is visiting his grandmother and staying at her mobile home. All of his luggage, all of his clothing, all of his belongings are essentially in the room where he is found dead, and she's in the doorway, his grandmother. And they look around, and there's not a lot of disturbance in the rest of the home. His truck is there as well. It's full of stuff. So every indication they have is that he's visiting his grandmother. Now, certainly from investigation, they learn that the crime likely occurred on September the 7th of 2005. They find a Walgreens receipt, and they find the Taco Bell receipt. They go to the Walgreens, and they see video of the grandmother and Stephen Folker, and they do interact with some people, but they're really just trying to place at that time the last time these two were seen alive. They go to Taco Bell as well, and the Taco Bell video is, as I'm sure is not a shock, isn't the best quality video in the world, but it's of a line of people waiting to order at Taco Bell. And Stephen Folker is present there, and he does say something to individuals. But at the time the detectives are viewing the video, they have no knowledge who either of those two are. It's not a long conversation. It's not video of them sitting at a table. He just makes an offhand comment, and the video is maybe 20 seconds long. And it doesn't indicate a connection between the two. So all they're looking at that point is video of their victim at Taco Bell on the afternoon of the 7th, and they don't make much of it. Now, certainly, it all comes together later on when they go down and serve the search warrant. But it's, in my opinion, an unfair standard to expect the detectives to instantly assess what might be a potential piece of evidence a month before they even realize its significance. It's on the 28th of September when they see the photograph of Richardson in the hat. And once they see that, they make every effort imaginable to try to recover the hat. Now, it was fruitless because the crime scene was already released and the hat had already been destroyed. But I don't think by any stretch of the imagination you could say they were negligent, one, in not realizing its evidentiary significance a month before they even knew who Richardson was, or because of their efforts to recover the hat after, because certainly they were very extensive. Because they never had actual control of this hat, I think the line of cases that are more instructive are the failure to gather evidence cases rather than Sparks and Sanborn, which are mentioned in the defense brief
and young blood, which are when the police actually have control of an item of evidence and release it, like a gun, in those Bill Sparks and Sanborn. Under Daniels and Steese and Randolph, those seem to fit the factual scenario we have here with regard to the hat. Daniels concerned a blood draw that was not taken from a defendant who later was claiming insanity. He claimed that because the police didn't draw the blood at the time, evidence wasn't collected that might have been helpful to him later on. Steese was a case where the police officers released a crime scene, and later on a pair of bloody jeans was found in the trailer, and I think a gold chain. And that evidence was never collected, and Steese later raised that as a failure to gather evidence claim. And Randolph was really similar to our case, like Steese, where there was clothing in possession of the co-defendant. The Randolph claimed that had the police examined that evidence, it might have shown that that guy, Garner, was the shooter rather than Randolph. But applying the test that is required in those three cases, or that's come forth in those three cases with regard to failing to gather evidence, there's sort of a high hurdle before you get the instruction. First, they have to show that the evidence was material, meaning favorable. Well, the hat in this case was the opposite. Richardson is wearing that hat, we know now, later, 2 hours before the homicide. So, I mean, we wanted the hat more than anybody. The hat, regardless of who it ever belonged to or the history of the hat, 2 hours before the murder, he's the one wearing the hat. There's no question about that. So it would have been...
The hat couldn't be identified in the video.
You could see, I mean, you can't see...
That's, I guess I'm curious as to how that was argued, how you argued that during the trial.
The hat was red, a red bill and white, and then it had a pattern on sort of the front of it. And the hat in the black and white video, you see a darker color, you see the little red button on the top, and you see the design, exactly where the design would be for the Auto 500 hat. And then my recollection is that we called Kim Ross, who was the girlfriend of Thomas Richardson, showed her the videotape, and she identified the hat as well. And Robert Dinhart, interestingly enough, when the police first talked to him, before we even know about the hat or they see the photograph of Richardson in the hat, describes what Richardson is wearing that day as well, which is consistent, obviously, as it turns out, with the Taco Bell tape.
So the point is that if the hat would have been preserved, they might have been able to discredit that evidence and say it didn't have any DNA, it wasn't his.
I don't know how you would, even with DNA,
right?
How would it not be his if he's wearing it 2 hours before on the day of the murder?
Well, there could be duplicate hats. I mean, I think it's their theory, right, that there could be similar hats.
There
could have been hair in the hat. I mean, their point is that they lost a forensic ability to say, I may have been in a hat, but it wasn't that hat.
Right. I think that's a little bit speculative. And in Steese and in Daniels and in Randolph, all of those cases say, you know, the mere hope that the DNA would have come back your way doesn't meet the favorability or materiality standard. So I think their hope that, hey, look, it might not have been Richardson's DNA in that hat.
Or his hair.
Or his hair is sort of... exactly similar to what this court found as not meeting the materiality or favorability standard in Steese, Daniel, and in Randolph. And then when you move on to the second part of the test, which is, was there negligence? I think certainly the conduct of the police, they did the best they could. It could hardly be labeled negligence, much less... the gross negligence standard, which is required.
Ms. Wickerly, could you clarify the record for me, please?
Sure.
First of all, the crime scene photos that depicted the hat were taken on September 10th?
The ones with the hat are on the 14th.
And the Taco Bell receipt, or excuse me, the Taco Bell video was viewed also on the 14th?
I think it was viewed on the 14th. I mean, the receipt was on the 7th. I think they tried to acquire the video But sometimes there's problems with matching video systems. But they certainly had the Taco Bell video concurrent with the 14th.
Concurrent or before?
Right.
The hat was photographed.
Right.
When was the crime scene released to the owner of the property?
The 16th of September it was released.
So 2 days after the video was observed and the hat was photographed, the crime scene was released.
That's correct.
And what was the explanation of the officers for not collecting the hat at that point?
There were a lot of pieces of clothing in the bedroom where Stephen Folker stayed.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of blood on the furniture. What they try to do is they don't collect every piece of furniture or every item of clothing for that matter. And they collect what has blood on it or what looks like it might have evidentiary significance. They don't have any reason to believe anyone but Folker ever stayed in that room, so they believed that the hat was his. They didn't see any blood or anything indicating that it might have significance in terms of evidence, and so that's why they didn't collect it. I mean, the room was swabbed and measured, but they didn't keep his suitcases, they didn't keep his T-shirts, they didn't keep a lot of things that were in that room.
Mm-hmm.
They just didn't realize the significance at the time.
All right. Thank you.
In terms of that issue, I would just say, based on the established case law, getting back to your question, Justice Seda, I don't think that this falls under the category of analysis of failure not preserving evidence. It's properly analyzed under failing to collect evidence and applying the standard in the three cases that I've discussed at length. I don't think they meet the standard required for a negative inference instruction, much less dismissal, which was actually litigated earlier in the case. With some of my remaining time, with the permission of the court, I would like to just highlight or discuss the corroboration.
You read my mind.
The corroboration issue in this case, because I know it's a factor, especially anytime you use accomplice testimony. And I actually reread the Hagelmeyer case this morning just to make sure I had it straight. And in Hagelmeyer, what the court found insufficient was accomplice testimony, where the corroboration essentially was that the co-defendants knew each other, they had some sort of relationship, that Hagelmeyer, along with some other people, might have had access to the gun that was eventually used in the murder, and that he generally met the height and weight description of one of the people seen at the crime scene. And this court found that level of corroboration insufficient in terms of what is needed to meet the statute when the state uses accomplice testimony under NRS 175-291. In this case, we had quite a bit more corroboration than was the case in Hagelmeyer, which the court even deemed a close case. In this case, we had several phone calls of Tom Richardson denying to Kim Ross and to Kim Ross in numerous phone calls that he had never been in Las Vegas. He also told that same lie to the police detectives when they came and spoke to him. He was further heard on phone calls talking to his uncle, where he's essentially trying to set up an alibi for himself on the date that the murders occurred. And the uncle's sort of confused about what he's talking about, but he's relaying to his uncle that I was watching the U.S. Open with you. Remember, I was down in California with you watching this at the time. Richardson was also, and this is testimony from Kim Ross, he was supposed to be home with the car on the date that the murder occurred on September the 7th. He wasn't there, and neither was the car. That's separate and apart from what Robert Denhart testified to. Kim Ross also indicated that Thomas Richardson had bought a pair of boots on September the 6th, which would have been the day before the murder. And on the 8th, after they returned home, from California. Those boots, according to Tom Richardson, he had just thrown them away because they had a broken lace. That was his reason to Kim Ross. So we have some missing clothing. Kim Ross also noted that after the homicide occurred, Tom Richardson had some money. Not thousands, but a couple hundred dollars, and he wasn't working. So that indicated that he got some of the cut or some money from the robbery in this case. She also mentioned the very popular Auto 500 hat and indicated in her testimony that that hat wasn't present, wasn't seen in the house after the homicide took place. And of course, that Tom Richardson is seen on the videotape with Robert Dennard and Stephen Fulker 2 hours before the murder with the hat. In later phone calls, Tom Richardson indicated to Kim Ross, his girlfriend, that he was pretty sure the police weren't going to find any blood in the car. This inside knowledge struck us, and we made the argument as odd. How would he know that if Robert Dennard committed this murder by himself or with someone else? How would he know what was dragged into the car? He also told in a more bold conversation to Kim Ross that he knew who Robert Dennard had committed the murder with, but he just wasn't going to tell her about it. And finally, when the police came down to interview Robert Dennard and Tom Richardson in California, they initially speak to Tom Richardson, and he sees them at Las Vegas homicide. They're in their shirts, and he immediately says, I know what this is about, and they say, or I know why you're here, and they say, well, we're here doing an investigation, and he says, oh, is this about Steve the Jew? And the detectives say, well, we're here to talk about an investigation regarding the death of Stephen Fulker. And Mr. Richardson then says that, oh, well, Robert Dennard, my sort of stepson, he worked for Fulker. Fulker didn't pay him very well. That's why we use that terminology. And he told me, Robbie told me what happened in Las Vegas. There's a little further conversation. Tom Richardson suggests to the detectives that he wants to talk to Kim Ross, who's Dennard's mother, before he tells them any more information. When they switch the two to go talk to Dennard, they walk Dennard by Thomas Richardson, and Richardson yells out to Dennard, don't tell him anything, Robbie. Keep your mouth shut. Now, he certainly, I think it's clear at this point, that he didn't do that on behalf of Robert Dennard. He basically had just served him up to the detectives in the previous conversation. So the implication that State drew, obviously, from that sort of comment was that he didn't want Dennard telling on his involvement in the homicide. And from there, all the conversation with the detectives was, I was never in Vegas. You could never place me in Las Vegas. It may not have been like the most conclusive case without Robert Dennard, but I believe that the corroborating evidence in this case was much more extensive than was the case in Hagelmeyer, and that the standard was clearly met for corroboration.
Ms. Wickerly, if we would take the testimony of the hat out, in other words, if we were looking at the transcript and we struck all the testimony about the hat and all the accomplice testimony, can you still prove this case beyond a reasonable doubt?
Without the hat, I think, and without the accomplice testimony?
Right. In other words, the accomplice testimony, we have to look at the evidence other than the accomplice testimony.
That's right.
And you seem to present that. But let's say we take, because you just keyed on some of the hat testimony. If we took the hat testimony out, is there still enough without the hat testimony?
That would be a much closer case. His conversations about making up an alibi and knowing who the killer is but not saying, and getting the money and getting rid of his clothing, I think those put you in a pretty good direction towards guilt, but whether a jury would find that, I don't know. I think the accomplice rules are in place for a reason. We want to make sure that people aren't convicted solely on the basis of accomplice testimony, but because there was such extensive corroboration in this case, I don't think those concerns are present.
You still have time.
Okay.
I didn't know if I... But you still, you have a couple minutes left.
Okay.
Almost 3 minutes.
All right. I guess in closing, I know there were several other objections that were raised in this case. In many of those situations, there weren't objections made contemporaneous at the time the evidence came into the record. But on the whole, there was a great effort in this case made to prove up the case independent of Robert Dennhart. I mean, we didn't have him as our witness until very late in the game. And so there was a lot of extensive analysis of Mr. Richardson's phone calls. With regard to the issues that were raised in terms of our penalty hearing, I think the first issue that was discussed by the defense in terms of penalty instructions, that was solved by this court's decision last October in Nunnery. The defense in this case also raised the fact that the jury found no mitigation in this particular case. And the penalty hearings are always this long list of things that anything could be mitigation. And the fact that our jury just didn't find the fact that Thomas Richardson had a good mother or Thomas Richardson was a good student as mitigation, I don't think rises to the level of error. I don't think there was any mitigation that was actually presented. By contrast, what we had was an individual with an extensive violent history. He had a robbery, he had a sexual assault, and every benefit was given to him along the way. And then he proceeded to trial on this case, which was an extremely violent double homicide with an elderly victim, which encompassed a murder as well. And he was well represented by counsel, as usual. But it was a fair trial, and the outcome was just. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rickley. Mr. Sheik, in rebuttal.
Your Honor.
Your team has 8 minutes and 51 seconds left. I didn't know if you were going to split the rebuttal or not.
I'm going to try not to hog it all up in talking about the closing argument issue.
Okay.
But I think it's important that this court take a look at the actual argument that took place and not the arguments that are being put forth here today. Because during my closing, this is the statement I make. And, in fact, Mr. Richardson does that, drives him to Las Vegas, that Ms. Weckerly. I'm going to object. There's no evidence of this. All I've talked about at that point is that Tom drove Robbie to Las Vegas, and they're already objecting. So for them to now say, well, we were really just talking about something that goes later on, they're already objecting.
So there was no the citation of the record was incorrect where it was
I'll
indicated
get to that.
That it was going back to Riverside?
We go on because they're still objecting. The court says, okay, and then they object again. It's speculative. And the court overrules him, and all I've said at this point is he drove him to Las Vegas and dropped him off, and they've already made two objections and been overruled. They're not just talking about the last little bit of the theory of defense. They're objecting in front of the jury to all of this. I then go on, Your Honor, and say Mr. Richardson is at the Taco Bell with Mr. Dennhart. Mr. Richardson drops him off at the trailer after eating at Taco Bell and returns to Southern California. Later, as he said to Kim Ross, Mr. Dennhart comes back to California and tells Mr. Richardson. They object again and say, assuming facts not in evidence. That fact was in evidence because the state put it in evidence. The state put in the phone call from Tom Richardson to Kim Ross where Tom says to Kim, Robbie came back and told me what he did in Las Vegas. That was the evidence. It's not fun assuming facts not in evidence. That's evidence the state put in that I'm trying to argue. And so it's just a continuation of their objecting to the whole thing. And the court sustained that objection. And the jury is instructed in the instructions, if the court sustains an objection to something, you have to disregard that. And you assume the jury is following their instruction. She sustained the objection. This is not, assumes facts, it's not in evidence, and it's sustained. At that point, we approach the bench. And you can read the entire colloquy at the bench where I talk about the phone calls. I talk about Robbie's testimony that the plan was that he was going to get driven up here and left with Mr. Folker and get a ride back some other way. I talk about the phone call that made to Kim Ross. The court was having nothing of that. And the court's ruling, and this is the court's ruling at the bench,
I think you can argue that you drove him here to Las Vegas. But the whole thing about dropping him off and turning around and coming back, there's no evidence of that. I was forbidden to go back to that subject whatsoever. I went back. I finished my argument by arguing what there wasn't evidence to put him there, as I had already argued, and I properly could have. But I was cut off. So it was, not once didn't this argument, did they say, well, he's talking about statements that were made, and those statements would be hearsay, and they're not admissible, and they shouldn't come in, and you shouldn't consider that. Well, the reason they didn't argue that is because they're the ones that put the statements in. They played the recordings where Tom said to Kim, this is what happened. They put them in. And so how can they argue now that somehow this is hearsay that the jury can't consider? And it is prejudicial. It is of a constitutional magnitude. And they've already conceded that you take the hat out of this and take the accomplice out of this. This is a close case when you properly look at what we should have been allowed to argue. And thank you very much.
I'd like to pick up where Mr. Sheik just left off. And in particular, the state argues here that the jury believed Denhart. That's not true. This jury didn't find that this was a premeditated murder. They found that it was a murder under the felony murder rule, at least one juror. Had the jury believed Denhart in his entirety, they would have found this to be a premeditated murder because it was his testimony that they were talking about this for hours in advance. There's no way that this would not be a premeditated murder if they believed every word out of Denhart's mouth. It was essential that Mr. Sheik be allowed to give his full explanation of those phone calls, of the evidence that the state's now relying upon for corroboration, to explain why those didn't implicate Mr. Richardson in the robbery, in the offenses. This is also critical to showing why we were entitled to that great caution instruction. You have a case here where Mr. Denhart has a bloody fingerprint at the scene. He purchased the murder weapon. He had the motive based upon his relationship with Mr. Folker. He's confessed to the police. Mr. Denhart has zero chance of winning this case at trial, and the state is seeking the death penalty against him. In exchange, he gets a minimal sentence. Second-degree murder, somewhere between 20 and 80 years. Some of it's running concurrent with his California time. That is an amazing bargain in exchange for his testimony implicating Mr. Richardson. And the jury should have been instructed, you need to look at that with great caution. You need to carefully consider that in light of the benefits that Mr. Richardson received. And the state argues, I'm sorry, that Mr. Denhart received. The state argues at one point, well, that's about informers. That's not about accomplices. Well, you know, I agree. This isn't about money. This isn't about getting 10 days off a jail sentence. This is going from the death penalty to 20 years. There's no amount of money that can give you back your life. There's no amount of working, selling marijuana, fixing houses, or anything else that's going to give Mr. Denhart a chance of seeing the streets again. His only option is testifying against Mr. Richardson, and that's what he does. And the jury absolutely should have been told, you need to take this testimony with great caution, just as this court has said in the Crow opinion, and I think it's important to note here, the state argued there's no Nevada law supporting that instruction. It's contrary to Nevada law to give it. They didn't cite authority in front of the trial court. They didn't address the authority that we cited in front of the trial court. And now in their answering brief, they make the same argument, and they say, look at the Origel case. The Origel case has nothing to say about jury instructions. It's a sufficiency of the evidence standard that says the jury gets to judge the credibility. And if this case is going to boil down to the credibility of Robbie Denhart, there's no way that that can be a fair situation without that jury instruction.
Ms. Thomas, was there any other evidence other than the hat to connect Mr. Richardson to the crime scene?
To being inside the trailer? No, that was it. And the state here, she stated that the detectives did the best they could. They didn't. They lifted up a bed and couldn't bother to take a single photo of what was under that bed before it was disturbed in that room. They saw a person in a hat on a video immediately before going to the crime scene, and they didn't preserve that hat. And, you know, we're not asking for CSI magic, evaluate the dust in the room. We're saying do some basic, good detective work. And that wasn't done here. They collected a suitcase. They collected clothing. They collected a cologne bottle. It is not asking too much for them to collect a hat, something that could easily fly off of someone's head, at a crime scene this small. This is not out in a field where there could be a million different things. This is a small room in a trailer with a limited amount of evidence. And if they can't bother to collect an item like this, okay, don't introduce evidence about it at a trial. That's the sanction. But as a matter of public policy, this court should be promoting good detective work. It's a double homicide. They should do good work, and we should expect nothing less. We certainly shouldn't allow someone to receive the death penalty in a situation like this, where they didn't collect the evidence, where they relied on the testimony almost exclusively of an accomplice. And I invite you to look at the Hagelmeyer case, to look at the Austin case. There is an innocent explanation for Mr. Richardson's, all of the corroborating evidence that they cite to him, and Mr. Sheik should have been allowed to explain that at closing.
You're account. Saying that the stock credibility instruction is not enough, that there needed to be a cautionary instruction because of the deal?
Absolutely.
And you requested the cautionary instruction?
We did. I don't have the citation with me right now. It's in the briefs. We quoted from it. We cited to the Crow case and asking for it. It should have been given. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Wickley and Ms. Thomas, Ms. Sheik, thank you for your arguments in this matter. Very good. The briefs were good, and this matter will stand submitted. We'll be in recess at 11:30.